There is so much to see here at the Rockwell Museum, but what's this room?
Oh, we don't usually welcome the general public into this space.
What is this?
Well, these are, frankly, these are lesser-known Rockwells. We're not sure how comfortable the public would be with them.
Ah, oh, this one's really gross.
That's called his first tracheotomy. Mr. Rockwell was unable to sell it.
Well, this one really gets at something basic about childhood.
Yes, that one is called Booger.
What's this one, with all the little boys screaming and tearing at their own bodies? Is that what they're doing?
That's called There Are Leeches in This Pond. I believe Mr. Rockwell intended it as a comic piece.
Huh. What's up with this one, the guy that's lying on the floor?
The title is After 5 Jägermeisters and a Little Green Pill. It depicts an unhappy day in the life of the artist. Now, I'm going to have to ask you to leave before you...
Oh, sweet baby Jesus, I can't unsee it!
Oh, dear. You've glimpsed the Human Caterpillar series. Most unadvisable.
And they're all trying to eat Thanksgiving dinner? I feel like I never really knew Norman Rockwell, which is the theme of today's show, getting to know America's best-known artist. Did Norman Rockwell have a Norman Rockwell life? And now he was the model for a little girl looking downstairs at a naked gypsy, Colin McEnroe. Hey, what's that one down there?
Don't look at that one. It makes your hair fall out.
All right, so it's not that bad, we promise. In fact, but you are going to get to know Norman Rockwell in a whole new way. I promise you that. This is an amazing story. It begins in the gaslit dregs of the 19th century, and it ends with Norman Rockwell rubbing shoulders with people like Al Kooper and Mike Bloomfield, people who are kind of founders of blues rock. And there's everything in between. And but it is sort of true that if we had to title the show, it's probably called Everything You Know About Norman Rockwell Is Wrong, at least the man himself. And so Deborah Solomon is joining us. She is the author of this fascinating new biography, American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. You also know her. Her name is synonymous, I think, with the Questions For column, which she perfected in her time with the New York Times Magazine. She's currently the art critic for WNYC. And we should mention that she will be at the Wadsworth Athenaeum on January 16th of next year. We'll tell you more about that. And in fact, I had a whole revelation today about Norman Rockwell and the Wadsworth Athenaeum. I had what's known as an idiotic eureka moment. But anyway, we'll explain that in just a second. Deborah Solomon, first of all, joining us from the studios of NPR Midtown in New York. So we're so excited to have you on the show.
Hi, Colin. Thank you for that gracious and hilarious introduction. I was glad to learn of all those new Rockwell paintings right. That I had somehow overlooked in my research.
Yeah, don't go in that room. That's my advice. So I scarcely know where to start, but I think we really do have to start because, in fact, I mean, there's no real template, I think, no kind of fictional or mythic template for the story that we're going to tell. But at times I felt a little bit like I was reading kind of a version, at least of the part of Citizen Kane, the idea that, you know, a kind of damage that you sustain in childhood winds up kind of animating you and driving you towards certain goals in life. And Rockwell didn't have, I don't think, the shattering trauma of Charles Foster Kane's childhood. But there is something about Rockwell's childhood that you get at that seems to be an itch that he can't quite scratch. So let's talk a little bit about this. Explain who he was growing up.
Okay. He was born in New York City in 1894, and he, it's true, did not suffer any great one trauma that scarred him, but he suffered the trauma of childhood itself. he felt as if his mother never looked at him. He felt ignored. He was a thin boy who was overshadowed by his athletic and academically stellar older brother. And the sense of inadequacy he felt in childhood, which is not that unusual for children, is one that for some reason he was never able to outgrow. And throughout his life, he suffered from exaggerated feelings of deprivation and also try to get people to look at him to compensate, I think, for the absent gaze of his childhood.
Yeah, and, you know, one can take this kind of thing too far, but I don't think we're taking it too far. At least you make a very persuasive case for the notion that in drawing these kinds of idyllic or iconic renderings of American childhood, especially American boyhood, he's certainly not recapitulating his own experience. He's trying to create an experience that he didn't have, trying to locate the all-American boy that he wasn't.
Exactly. He is able to relive his childhood or recreate it according to his imaginative vision of a childhood. And it does not have a lot to do with his own childhood or with the childhoods of his children, who he didn't use much as models. He certainly wasn't portraying their childhood.
And there's, I don't know, there's so much in all this. I guess let's pause over one aspect of it, too, and not to overemphasize this. But, you know, you as a biographer are having to kind of look at these impulses. And Rockwell existed and was fascinated by American childhood and by American boyhood and therefore by American boys at a time when it was kind of more okay to have some of the interests that he had, and people's minds didn't immediately go towards pedophilia or anything like that. I mean, when we look at these biographies, you know, we start worrying, are we heading off towards J.M. Barrie town or Lewis Carroll town or something like that? With Rockwell, it's iffy, and you a couple of times during the book sort of, you know, kind of hover over this flame for a second. I mean, one of the first things we see him doing. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say I deliberately didn't use the word gay. Mm-hmm. Because who knows why two men sleep in a bed on a fishing trip? I mean, it could be Brokeback Mountain, or maybe it was just cold out that night.
That's it. That's him and Fred.
Exactly. Yeah. And that appears to have been a convention of the time. I mean, guys were very chummy with each other. Women, you know, were home. They weren't in the workplace. They didn't mingle as much with men. And, you know, male company may have been more homosocial than it is now, meaning guys just sitting together in boats all day. I didn't want to put a label on it because the word gay sets off alarm bells. It seemed too easy. In Rockwell's case, I was more interested in understanding why he was reaching out for men in both his work and his life. What did a rugged boy provide him with that he felt was missing from his own life?
And it seems as though, I mean, one of the early scenes that we're treated to of this that's a little unsettling by today's standards, he moves to New Rochelle and he's beginning this part of his career and he's looking for certain kinds of boys that because he draws from life or paints from life a lot of the time. He's looking for a certain kind of boy and he'll actually stop little boys on the street and kind of turn them around and inspect them to see if they can be of use to him, which is something that you'd be—
Put them in his car. He would be arrested today, for sure, for that kind of behavior. But it's what artists do. Artists are figure painters, and they're constantly assessing individual bodies. And it was a more innocent era in which I don't think anyone was really thinking pederasty or gayness the way we do today.
You know, I thought one of the better lines about your book was, I think, written in The New Yorker by one of the critics that you mentioned in the book, who said, you know, it wasn't at the end, Deborah Solomon doesn't show us Norman Rockwell as a person behaving badly. She shows him as a person kind of not behaving at all in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, his personal life was so lukewarm as to be kind of barely there at all.
Well, his emotional life was very repressed, but kind of a lot went on in his life. He somehow managed to get married three times. He had children. He was constantly traveling. He was a very restless man who was often on the road, who seemed incapable of staying put anywhere for long, and but his life, so I wouldn't say his life was completely uneventful, especially compared to Joseph Cornell, the subject of my last book, who never left his house on Utopia Parkway and died a virgin.
Right, if we're going to set the bar there.
Really, but really. Yeah, Joseph Cornell is the ultimate homebody. Rockwell was out there, but he was somebody who doesn't seem really— I don't think he enjoyed himself much.
Right. The peripatetic qualities were a surprise to me. Well into his 60s, his late 60s, he's going to Moscow and then taking a detour from there to Africa. I mean, he's really all over the world. But just to come back to this other part
anywhere.
Of it.
He racked up more miles than a traveling salesman, I am sure.
But just to go back to this sort of issue of his emotional life, this is the thing I think, this is one of the revelations of this book, I think, is that this is a guy who infused infuses his paintings with so many kind of crackling images of interior life made exterior, you know, so many. And yet he seems to have as little relationship with his wives as can be had. And it's often at a very kind of distant, I mean, he really is the distant father, the distant husband, the distant brother. I mean, the signal complaint about Norman Rockwell from the people around him is that they don't know him very well. He's not very communicative with them. And he doesn't seem as interested in them as he is in other things.
Right. He was very distant. He's like Camus' L'étranger, the stranger, who was alienated, really, from his own parents and his brother, certainly, whom he was not close to, and from his wives and his children. So, but for an artist, that's not so unusual. I mean, most artists kind of save the best part of themselves for their art and do not have a lot of energy to expend on the running of a household or on other people's feelings. So I do think Rockwell's most intense relationships were probably with his models, mm-hmm. who he certainly looked at very lovingly over days and days, and with his doctors. He loved doctors, and we're not up to the 50s yet, but of course he was very indebted to his shrink, Erik Erikson.
I can't wait to talk about the Erik Erikson part of this. This is so fascinating to me.
I'm impressed you're going in order. Yeah, well, you have so much discipline.
No, yeah, I'm scattering all over the place, really, but it looks like we're going in order. Actually, we are going to go out of order just for a second here. I want to quickly say, first of all, you may be tweeted at and you may tweet at us at WNPR Colin. Our tweet master, Greg Hill, is in the house. And you may also phone the show here in the afternoon. We're live, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. That, Deborah Solomon, has already happened, and I think you're going to be very interested in the phone call we've got here from Stephanie in Washington, Connecticut. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you're on the air.
Hi, Stephanie.
Oh, good. I was just calling because my father, as a young boy, he's in his 60s now, was painted by Rockwell. His aunt was actually a botanical painter. He grew up in Danbury, and she took him to meet Rockwell. And Rockwell was kind of fascinated. My dad had two different size ears, and he was taken by him and did a series of paintings for seasonal, spring, summer, winter, and fall. They're not super famous, but we have them up on our wall. So
it sounds like he posed for the Four Seasons calendars.
Yeah, maybe. It's him with a little girl in the spring and then holding pumpkins in the fall.
Did he have any memories of this experience? Any memories of just being in the room with Rockwell?
He said he was very serious. That's all he really remembers.
Which was, Deborah Solomon, not always the case with Rockwell. One of the things that he did with his subjects to loosen them up was, I mean, he although he was a very serious man in a lot of ways, he was also pretty good at joking around with people.
Right. He was like a stage director who knew how to really surround himself with fabulous props, including pianos. He would bring a piano into his studio if he had a painted piano. He once ordered blood from the Red Cross so he could really see how blood looked. And he was very good at, yes, warming up all his models and getting them to hold the very uncomfortable poses that he needed them to hold, sometimes for hours on end.
Well, if we're going to talk about the blood, we should quickly talk also, because this is my idiotic eureka moment, okay? So I go to the Wadsworth Athenaeum all the time. Mm-hmm. I haven't been in a couple of years, but I've been walking around. So
it's an incredible institution. I think it's the oldest museum in America, isn't it?
It claims to
it's
be.
It's either that or the Albright Knox in Buffalo. It's one or the other.
So, you know, and so looking at the picture. The girl with the black eye in your book. I sort of thought I had forgotten that I'd seen that at the Athenaeum. I just assume it's kind of an iconic Rockwell work that I just had absorbed from wherever. And I was in communication with the Athenaeum today about your upcoming appearance there. And I said, well, what do you really have in the collection? And they said, well, we have the girl with the black eye. And I said, you don't have the oil of the girl with the black eye. You can't. And they said, no, we have it. That's where it is. And so that was my idiotic eureka moment. But since we're going to mention that, this is a great story of the kind of thing you're talking about, of Norman Rockwell ordering blood from the Red Cross so he can get blood right. He's got the girl. He's got the girl he wants to base this. And for people who don't know the painting, it's this young girl with a black eye. She's sitting outside what seems to be the principal's office, and she's got this smile on her face, like just, you know, you should have seen the other guy, basically, kind of smile. I think that's
very
what,
satisfied grin.
Yeah. And
she's
so,
a triumphant tomboy in a skirt.
So he's already got the girl that he wants to use. It's a girl that he uses in another really famous and very, very different painting later. But he doesn't have the black eye, and I'm going to let you pick up the story from there.
And he needs to look at objects when he paints them. He doesn't like to work from his imagination. He likes to have the object in front of him. So the question was, how could he see a black eye? He was not going to punch this girl in the eye to give her a black eye, thank God. So he took out ads and advertised for a good black eye and went also and visited hospitals in the Pittsfield area and eventually settled on a little boy who had what he considered to be a beautiful black eye. Now, a black eye is actually many colors, and I think that's what he wanted to look at. A black eye is not black. It has red and green and yellow and every shade of the rainbow in it, which I had never really thought about until I heard him reflect on the search for the perfect black eye. It's hard to paint a bruise because a bruise has as many colors as a landscape.
And, you know, this all happens in around 1954 when, you know, at this point, he really is kind of a rock star. You know, I mean, Norman Rockwell asking for you to come to him with a black eye is, you know, it really, he didn't have any trouble getting volunteers, right?
No, he didn't. But again, today, that's something that might be seen as a little bit questionable. Wouldn't it?
Well, not as questionable. I mean, look,
going on fishing trips and sharing beds.
See, that doesn't strike me as questionable. I sort of get that. No, I mean, I think, you know, we get into the creepy areas, for example, when, one of the very few paintings that he does that is, you know, even the slightest bit sketchy, I mean, in the sort of the pedophilic area, of course, is the little boy about to get his shot. And you just you describe him bringing the painting to the boy's family's house, and he wanted to look at the pants again. And, you know, that was where I was. You tell the rest of that story.
Yeah. The boy in the pediatrician's office, who everyone knows that image. It's hanging in a lot of doctors' offices. The boy who drops his pants and is awaiting an injection and is bending over to look at the doctor's certification on the wall to make sure the doctor is properly qualified to give him a shot. Well, I did interview that boy, Eddie Locke, who is no longer a boy, and he said he did feel uncomfortable about it. He was unhappy when Rockwell told him to drop his pants. He just did it. He didn't think about it. Rockwell was an authority figure and somebody to be obeyed. And he felt uncomfortable. He said during his childhood when kids made fun of him for having exposed his rear on the cover of a national magazine. He also said that after the painting was done, although he didn't have any kind of relationship with Rockwell, one night, Rockwell did knock on the family's door, and Eddie Locke's mother opened the door, and Rockwell said he wanted to make sure that he got the color of the boy's pants right. Could he see the pants? And could he have the pants?
You know, as Bill Murray
that's
says,
a little,
Tootsie, we're getting into a weird area here. You know,
yeah,
at that point.
No, it's just, it's not anything you can put a label on. It's true. Weird is as good a word as any for Rockwell in some ways because it doesn't fit into any categories. Maybe he really wanted to see the color of the pants, you know, or maybe not. Maybe he got a fetishistic connection from fabric. He did love fabric. He spent every night shredding diaper cloth into paint rags to use in his studio the next day. And a lot of figurative painters love fabric because if you think about figurative painting, it's really just a head and fabric, unless you're painting nudes.
Right.
Clothing and fabric is a big part of figurative art.
And yet his desire to get things right is just so obvious. I mean, really, you look at these things and, you know, now you can go on websites where they have a magnification feature where you can really look at detail. And it's amazing stuff. Listen, we want to take a quick break here. There's so many things we need to cover, ranging from just kind of where he stands in the world of art these days, how he's understood and how he has been understood over time, why you decided to have this be your third artist biography, and, of course, the Eric Erickson stories.
Oh, and meanwhile, Norman Rockwell was just painting wonderful pictures, such wonderful pictures. He's the greatest painter of the 20th century, but nobody wants to talk about him in one of those art classrooms.
All right. Welcome back to our show. We're so excited, particularly on this day of all days, to have Deborah Solomon, who is the author of this brand new biography of Norman Rockwell, American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. She's here with us. She's going to be at the Athenaeum on January 16th of next year, but you don't wait that long to get this and really get this biography. It really is. There's just so much in it. There's stuff on every page, and it really does span. It tells this incredible story of America for about 75 years, too. So, you know, I want to sort of break off from the sheer biographical end of this and make sure we have a little bit of time to talk about the painter himself and kind of how he's understood and how he's looked at and how he can be looked at in so many different ways. And maybe since it is the day that it is today, maybe the best way to do that is to talk about Freedom from Want, which is the famous Thanksgiving painting. Now, I'm going to ask the people listening, get your mental picture in your head of what this painting is. You know, it's people around the Thanksgiving table and there's a turkey arriving. And you probably are picturing right now kind of a very Hallmarky looking thing that's full of sort of placidity and satisfaction and stasis. But Deborah Solomon, like so many Norman Rockwell paintings, there's really a lot more going on there as you look at it. I'll let you take over.
I could look at that painting forever. I'm constantly debating it with my friends. It is so layered with meaning and mystery, incredible mystery in that painting. It's probably my favorite Rockwell, and I think what I love about it is that it's a scene of Thanksgiving in which no one is giving thanks. Mm-hmm. If you look at earlier images of Thanksgiving, people's head are kind of bent in prayer at the table, and there's a certain piety, a religious piety about the scene. But here Rockwell shows people laughing with one another and having fun. And laughing, of course, shows that, you know, not only do we have traditions, but we in America could laugh at our own traditions. They're kind of hokey and they're kind of great, and we don't take ourselves too seriously. So I love the mood of that painting. The turkey is impossibly large. It's supersized. It's just bigger than any turkey ever. And if you look at the painting carefully, there's really no room on the table. The woman is lowering the turkey, but if she actually put it down on the table, she would knock over a water glass. And so it's a great symbol of abundance.
In the lower right-hand corner of the painting, too, there's a man looking at us.
It's a wink, wink.
Yeah, he's looking out at the gazer at the painting and saying something. He's sort of saying, "Is this insane or what?" I mean, it's hard
exactly.
to divine. And of course, I
didn't put this in the book. There's a lot of things I left out actually because, you know, you don't want to start an argument over every painting, and my personal interpretation might not be someone else's interpretation. But there's really no way, if you try to figure out who's with who at that table, there's no way to assemble a family. There are more guys. It's like a bunch of guys having Thanksgiving dinner. And there are more men than women.
And of the women, this is also the only place that Norman Rockwell's mother, with whom he had, as you have suggested earlier, a very complicated relationship, but a very unsatisfactory relationship. This is the only time that her face is used in any painting as kind of
exactly.
a side
and
character.
Look at that likeness. For those of you looking at the painting, or if you look at it later, the mother is a ghost. Mm-hmm. She's paler than anyone else. She's just not a vivid presence, and she's not looking really. No one's looking at her. She seems irrelevant to the air of conviviality and togetherness at the table.
You know, Deborah Solomon, as an art critic and somebody who has written biographies mm-hmm. of Jackson Pollock and Joseph Cornell, you know, Norman Rockwell isn't sort of the next natural progression by most people's lights. This is a guy who, you know, I mean, his critical fortunes have risen and fallen probably a couple of times over the years. But, you know, the default position until pretty recently was that this was the summation of American middlebrow taste, that this is what most Americans in a kind of Philistine blinkeredness assume is art, you know, but it isn't really. It doesn't really undertake art the way art is supposed to be. And yet,
exactly.
He's seen a lot of different ways. I'll just let you riff on that for a bit.
Well, I think it's interesting that none of the critics reviewing my book have questioned whether he's an artist. I was kind of dreading that. I thought, I hope we're not going to have to go through this whole rigmarole again where people say, why is she writing a biography about this junk? That has not come up at all. Everyone, I think, now accepts, 35 years after Rockwell's death, that he's here to stay, that his work has the complexity and lasting power of any abstract artist from the 1950s. And I say abstract artists from the 50s because those were the people, of course, who were glorified during his lifetime. a time when abstract art was seen to be the great style of modernism and avant-garde art, and drips and splashes and abstract forms were somehow seen to contain more emotion than views of a grocery or a beauty parlor or a barbershop or the everyday scenes that Rockwell painted.
Go ahead.
That was classic modernism. Modernism did not really want to look too much at figurative and realist painting. It was all about the glorification of Jackson Pollock, de Kooning, and abstract painting. Now, however, we're living in a postmodern age, which is not necessarily a great artistic renaissance. But one thing I love about postmodernism is it relaxes all the categories. And it doesn't matter. We're not interested in saying, is it art? It's not an interesting question anymore. I recently saw a headline in the Times that referred to bartending as an art. And I thought, okay, you know what? If bartending is an art, we don't have to ask whether Rockwell is an art. Rockwell represents art. And I think, Colin? Help me out here.
Well, maybe a place to go from there is, you know, among the people, as you illustrate, among the people who really weren't interested in that conversation about whether Rockwell was art were other artists. So you've got de Kooning basically saying that he thinks Rockwell is terrific. And just to sort of, once again, orient people a little bit, there's a fairly famous Rockwell painting from 62 called The Connoisseur, which shows this man looking at what is pretty clearly a sort of a Jackson Pollock-type canvas. And de Kooning says, well, you tell them what de Kooning says.
Yeah, de Kooning walks into a gallery, sees the painting of the connoisseur of the painting's title, looking at it at a Pollock drip painting, and he said, what did he say? He said, that Pollock is better than a Pollock that Jackson could do.
Right. He's inch for inch.
Is that what
he's
he said?
Yeah, that Rockwell has so dedicated himself to making, even though there's sort of a little joke, like as there so often is in a Rockwell painting, there's some kind of joke being told, but Rockwell wants to tell the joke with a painting. And it's clear, I think, also, that from Jump Street, he, Rockwell, although he's going to participate in this very photorealistic kind of illustration his entire life, you know, he's really interested in, I mean, he's a huge Picasso fan from the time of the Armory Show forward. He's very interested in this other kind of art.
He's very interested in modernism. He completely understands it. He admires it. And he often chastises himself. From time to time, he goes to Europe and thinks, gee, I have to learn how to be an abstract painter and be a modernist. You cannot make a modernist out of him. But I think there's room in the world for people who are not arch modernists, in addition to the 4,000 modernists who make up the canon in school. There are also people who stand outside the canon, and he's one of them. The work continues to fascinate.
And as you suggest, the circle kind of closes on itself by the time we get to postmodernism, where, you know, that debate isn't going on so much anymore. And then all of the ways that Rockwell can really sort of get, well, I mean, I think Warhol
says
something
about
that. I find
that artist, Warhol bought two Rockwells, of course. Mm-hmm. Warhol admired Rockwell very much because Warhol himself was an artist of Americana. What's a Campbell's soup can if not Americana with a kind of ironic spin on it? But I think I found during my research that artists from all different schools generally admired Rockwell, whether they were abstract painters or contemporary painters, 30-year-old painters starting out now. They spoke very highly of his technical prowess and his vision and his sense of humor. And I think the people who criticized him in the 20th century were critics. And it was a great century for critics. I mean, Clement Greenberg is practically a household name, because he was so famous in his lifetime for classifying art into high and low. And then there was Dwight MacDonald, who added the middle category. And it was very important to modernist critics that the art that they championed was difficult to understand. They really believed that modernism was supposed to be inaccessible to the bourgeoisie and the middle class. And one reason they disliked Rockwell is that he was popular. Today we can see the total absurdity of that argument. We like popular artists. We want artists to be popular.
I think the others strike against him to a certain degree, and it's a burden borne by others as well, including Maxfield Parrish. It's just that, you know, he worked for money in a certain way. He was an illustrator. You know, his work appeared in a different way. There was a different kind of output, too. I mean, 5,000 or more works, that's you don't really see that so much with people who are trying to maintain themselves as high artists.
You're right. It was a modernist no-no. Rockwell earned a paycheck that was really frowned upon. You're supposed to be a bohemian and go starve in a garret in Paris.
We've got to, just quickly, we're talking to Deborah Solomon, and we'd be remiss, since we're sitting here in Hartford, if we didn't mention a couple of interesting Hartford connections. One of them is, Rockwell's longest-suffering wife, Mary, had gigantic psychological problems, you know, pretty much classic depression and some alcoholism and stuff like that. So this wound her up at, whenever Hartford is mentioned in in a biography of any kind, there's about a 65% chance it's because somebody went to the Institute of Living, which is what happened this time. I'll let you take over.
Aren't you on Asylum Road?
We're on Asylum, yeah, although that's a little bit
different. I noticed
your
address. Is that the same asylum?
No, it's not the same asylum, no.
Okay. Yes, his wife was originally treated at Austin Riggs in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, as was Rockwell himself. But when she was not helped by her treatment there, she was sent off to the Institute of Living, which was a place that offered shock treatment and straitjackets and a much more controlling atmosphere than the one at Riggs. So she did spend about 4 months there in 1955, summer and the fall, and Rockwell occasionally visited her there. And he once, on one of his trips, gave an interview to a reporter from the Hartford Courant. And it's a fascinating article. First of all, he never turned down interviews. So it's interesting, first of all, that he agreed to speak to a reporter in Hartford when he was visiting his poor institutionalized wife. But the reporter asked him directly, "What are you doing here?" And Rockwell makes up this elaborate story about how he's practicing his sketching and he loves the architecture of Hartford. Mm-hmm. He came there to practice drawing buildings.
Yeah, he compares the Capitol to the Taj Mahal or something.
Exactly. And it's just a fascinating piece that reveals how much he was determined to hide behind a humorous facade and a folksy facade his whole life and not let on that he was a man afflicted with many problems, both domestic and otherwise.
And we're going to get to those in a second. I'm getting a tweet from Tara Cantor right now who says, of the 5,000, you're not responsible, Deborah Solomon, for all 5,000 plus illustrations, but it says, did you already talk about the optician sketched at Harvey and Lewis in Hartford? Harvey and Lewis is this kind of classic old style, you know, family owned optician place. I didn't know that there was that connection.
There's a boy and his optician. And it's an important painting for Rockwell because he was obsessed, of course, with vision and the gaze. So it makes sense that he would be aware of eyeglasses. He had about 50 pairs of glasses in his studio, and he would wear them when he painted.
So we've got to spend a few minutes here. I mean, when I first got this biography, the thing that just leapt out at me is the Eric Erickson connection. I had no idea about this. So Rockwell's living in Stockbridge. He relocates his family from Arlington, Vermont, to Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Doesn't tell his brother, by the way. And so, and his wife is, as you say, under the care of this Austin Riggs institution, where she's formed this long-term bond with a therapist there. But eventually,
Dr. Knight, who was head of the institution.
But eventually, Rockwell, and Rockwell is, we haven't really said this yet, but Rockwell is beset by a whole series of what we would call maladies. He's a hypochondriac. He's an insomniac. Mm-hmm. He has something pretty close to OCD and an obsession with cleanliness to a point where at times he spends more of his day cleaning his studio than he does actually painting in the studio. I mean, he's got some things gnawing at him, and he winds up in the care of Eric Erickson, who's newly arrived in this country and probably paired up with Rockwell because, in some respects, he's a little bit of a dashing, romantic, artistic figure himself.
Oh, very much so, and was an artist in his youth, actually wandered Europe in his youth trying to make it as a painter. And I've seen some of his woodblock prints. They're pretty good. So he was uniquely qualified to understand Rockwell's problems, especially because a lot of Rockwell's problems centered on his dissatisfaction with his work and his feeling that nothing was good enough. And he would wake often in the morning feeling like there was a new day. He felt hopeful. He was going to get something done. But by the end of most days, he felt an incredible sense of despair and disappointment because he, you know, hadn't been able to do in his studio what he had hoped to do. And this was something that Eric Erickson, it's a conversation that Erickson was able to enter into very fully and knowingly. He would actually drop by Rockwell Studios, and many of their sessions sounded more like art crits, where Erickson would sit and discuss the parts of a painting with him and reassure him that the painting was done. It was fine. Don't rework that leg, Norm. It's fine the way it is. So Erickson mostly treated children in Stockbridge, by the way. That was his specialty. But he happily took on Rockwell, and they became very close friends in addition to being patient and doctor, and their relationship was very unconventional, and I think probably the best relationship that Rockwell had in his life.
Isn't that something, though? And for people who this isn't ringing a bell or something, Eric Erickson's, classic book is probably Childhood and Society, but this is really one of the, sort of second generation after Freud, really, one of the huge figures in the world of psychoanalysis and psychiatry. I guess the question that I had too, it is an unusual relationship and they belong to this kind of social, kind of quasi scholarly group, and they write
like
back and forth.
It was like a frat, yeah. Marching and Chowder Society. Can you believe it? They have lunch every Tuesday with the other guys in town.
There's all this, but did you ultimately decide, was there a sense in which Erickson sort of ever came down for a landing on Rockwell and Rockwell's problems? I mean, this is the kind of thing that, as a matter of ethics, he really couldn't necessarily share ultimately with the public. I'm curious, I guess, also
who
because—
Who couldn't share?
Well,
who
how could Erickson really sort of say to the public, well, I think this is a case of classic blah, 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 blah. I mean, do you think Erickson sort of came down in a certain place about all this?
Well, I have the letters that they wrote to one another and the papers between them because the children, Rockwell's three sons, were kind enough to sign the necessary legal forms that gave me access to all that material. And no one had looked at that material before. And from what I could see, Rockwell complained a lot about his work and his marriage during his sessions. And Erickson tried to help him with that. I don't think it went much deeper than that.
I kind of want to know ultimately from Erickson, he's so interested elsewhere in his work on inanality, and whether it's Luther's constipation or I think Kion Wolf, I think, told you that I actually had the opportunity to sit and breathe the same air as Eric Erickson on one occasion. And he immediately went there. He just started talking about pooping right away. I can't really tell you the story on the air because it has a bad word in it, which he said, but I'll tell you off the air. But,
I have to tell you something since you brought that up. That in Rockwell's correspondence to Erickson, he talks about something that I left out because I found it just kind of unsavory. He talks about the regularity of his movements. And I did not put that in. You would have put it in. But I thought, do we really need, if it's not any deeper than that, do we really need that in the book?
You may not need it, and I may not need it, but Eric Erickson would have needed to know about Rockwell's pooping.
That he was regular on this one trip to Europe when Rockwell was writing to him. He was reporting on his bowel movements, and I thought, oh, my God, I hope these letters go deeper than that. There were some things, even as a biographer, I don't want to know. I didn't want to know about that, and I certainly didn't include it in the book.
All right. Well, that'll be in my biography of you.
It's funny because I thought, is Rockwell this focused on his bowel movements that he talks about it? But you're saying everyone discussed that with Erickson.
I'm thinking if you're hanging around with Eric Erickson, it's like, if you hang around with Ted Williams, you're going to talk about batting. Hanging around with Eric Erickson, you're going to talk about pooping.
That's hilarious.
On that note, we have to take a quick break. We have more to come after this.
Full of nice and not a kid. Oh, to look at life back then, just like Norman Rockwell did.
Wow, Norman Rockwell really was ahead of his time. How did he come up with three large women twerking back in 1974? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our intern, Jackie Lauper. The part of Bill Curry was played by Arnold Palmer. Greg Hill appeared in the introduction and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. For stories, photos, links, and a Norman Rockwell painting of the Faith Middleton show staff with their pants down getting a polio shot, visit our great website, WNPR.org. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday. We'll be back on Friday with a rebroadcast of one of our favorite shows about scholarly studies of the Beatles. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, so I'm here with Deborah Solomon. Well, she's actually not physically here. She's in the NPR Midtown studios. But and we're having this conversation, which I wish could go on for two more hours, about American Mirror, the life and art of Norman Rockwell, her new biography of Norman Rockwell. You know, we're going to add Stephanie Plunkett to the conversation in just a second. She's deputy director and chief curator of the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. But before we do, Deborah Solomon, I mean, there's so much ground to cover, really. We could talk about this for another couple hours. But we really just do have to say something about this kind of later period of Rockwell, where he kind of makes this incredible leap from the kinds of Saturday Evening Post illustrations that we know him for, you know, these sort of classic expressions of American spirit and of youth and childhood and people looking in mirrors. And suddenly there's this social statement that comes out. I mean, the most famous one is the problem we all live with, which is the little African-American girl in between the U.S. Marshals with the tomato that's been hurled at her, splattered against the wall, and the horrible things drawn on the wall. And, you know, this kind of comes out of nowhere. It seems, anyway, to come out of nowhere. Tell us about this.
It's a great painting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the defining image of the civil rights movement. And just as he did the defining images of World War II when he painted the Four Freedoms, he later reflected very beautifully on civil rights in that one painting of Ruby Bridges being escorted to school in New Orleans. I think there were many reasons why he painted it. One, he had left the Saturday Evening Post, which pretty much threw him out. In the 60s, they no longer wanted him to paint everyday genre scenes. They wanted him to paint pictures of celebrities. They sent him to California to paint Bob Hope. As much as I love Bob Hope, he did not want to paint portraits of celebrities and left the Post around 1962 and started working for Look magazine, which assigned him to brilliantly to do civil rights pictures. It was the 1960s, and I think that was the narrative. That was the American narrative, as much as freedom from want and fear and the others was the narrative of the World War II years.
At this time, and we're compressing heavily here, but
I should say, yeah, he was always fairly apolitical.
Yeah,
he was. He registered as a moderate Republican in his youth. I told his children that because I did find his election records in Westchester County, New York, and when I told his children that both their father and their mother were registered as Republicans, they were shocked.
Yeah. Towards the end, of course, he paints the portraits of both Goldwater and LBJ, and he says he didn't vote for Goldwater, but Goldwater was an easier person to work with.
He did become more liberal. He became more liberal as he became older, no doubt about it.
The other thing that happens fascinatingly is his paths cross with all these other like rock and roll people. In the sense that something that has been so classically American and understood in a certain way can become cool. You know, rock and roll people decide, well, because that's kind of cool. I mean, Norman Rockwell is so down to earth that he's the opposite of that. He's kind of cool. So you have Al Kooper and Mike Bloomfield, these founders of blues rock, and Al Kooper goes on to start Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They wanted a Norman Rockwell painting of themselves.
And what about David Bowie called, but Molly told him it would take 6 months. And David Bowie said, you know, that he was amazed that anyone could spend 6 months working on anything. They admired his craftsmanship. And again, I think that's another example of artists understanding what he did. They saw how much skill went into the covers and how much vision there was. I mean, his work doesn't look like anyone else's work. And that, to me, is what art is. An artist puts something totally original, something that does not exist, into the world of things.
Let's grab Stephanie Plunkett here. She's a deputy director and chief curator, as I said, at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. I want to say two quick things here before I run out of time. One of them is that Rand Cooper was going to join us today. He had just visited the museum in Stockbridge and was just transported by and heavily engaged by what he found up there and came up with all kinds of interesting things for us to talk about today. I've incorporated them into my thinking. The other thing I want to say just before I run out of time is that it is Thanksgiving tomorrow, and I want to say thank you to all the listeners we have out there also. I get to work every day with these two amazing amazing, incredible women, Kion Wolf and Betsy Kaplan. And I'm very grateful for the chance to work at WNPR with all the people here, but especially with these two incredible producers. They're fabulous. Stephanie Plunkett, I don't know if attendance at the Norman Rockwell Museum rises and falls with the seasons. I suppose leaf peeping season is the time people are in Stockbridge. But do you have a sense of what people are looking for when they go, when they come to your institution? What do they expect to find there?
You know, I think that they expect to find a positive experience that really transports them in a way to seeing the best in themselves. And I think that's something that Rockwell always did. I think his art has always been aspirational. You know, people feel that there's a sense of humanity about his work, and we certainly saw that when we had an exhibit at the Guggenheim right after September 11th, the highest visited exhibition that they had had to that point. So you see that people really are trying to, or coming in at least, really wanting to have a feeling of positive reflection on humanity.
You know, Deborah Solomon.
Hi, Stephanie. Yeah. Hi, Stephanie. It's Deborah here. Can you
hear
me?
Hi, Deborah. I can
hear you. Hi. I wanted to say it's interesting that you use the word aspirational, because mm-hmm. aspirational often refers to material aspiration. But with Rockwell, it wasn't about getting more money or having a better house and a better car. It really was about being the best American you could
Absolutely.
Be, meaning being nice to the girl next door or mm-hmm. the old lady next door.
Yeah,
and
I think
in that
he
sense,
really conveyed those basic human values that we want to believe are still present in the world. And I do think people feel uplifted when they look at his art.
You know, speaking of money, another thing that's about to happen on December 4th is the seven Rockwell paintings at Sotheby's are going to go on the block. And you know, in some ways, Deborah Solomon, there kind of isn't a lean period for Rockwell. You know, as Stephanie just said, there's the Guggenheim exhibit right after September 11th. And, I mean, it seems like just every day or any year you could pick up the paper and read something about this. But this is going to be, for example, the Gossips, I think the thing that you use to illustrate the cover of your book. I believe that's on the block, right?
Yes, I was somewhat horrified because I try to stay free of commerce. I like to think I'm pure as a critic and a writer. But it turns out that the very painting on the cover of my book is now coming up for auction. Mm-hmm. So I've been tainted by the market.
And Stephanie, I assume this auction is going to break Rockwell records and may break other kinds of records as well.
Yeah, I mean, we believe that it probably will. And, you know, the marketplace is also, it's always an indicator in a way of people's interests, obviously. So the museum has really been working for years to promote Rockwell's work in terms of, you know, having people understand its significance. And it's interesting to see that we are at a time when Rockwell's art has kind of come full circle from being underappreciated, certainly during his own time as a painter and as an artist. But today we see a different story. We really see a lot of public interest in his work.
Yeah, it is. You know, one of the things you recount, Deborah Solomon, in the book is when he gets the exhibit at the Corcoran, which is, you know, quite a feather in his cap, except that the critical reaction to it is kind of what Stephanie was just alluding to. He's very hurt by that, too.
In the 1950s, I didn't find any negative reviews of his work until the 1950s, so I'm convinced that he was demonized during that era precisely because it was the heyday of abstract painting, and he was the opposite of an abstract painter.
All right. We have like about 60 seconds left here, I regret to say. So I'd like each of you just quickly, and just won't have much more time than just the name of it, but if people wanted to jump online and try to find one more Rockwell painting besides the ones we've talked about that would maybe help them see Rockwell in yet another light. Deborah, you go first. There's one that you'd like to direct people to today?
Yes. The Metropolitan Museum owns a study for Freedom of Fear. I'm talking about, Freedom from Fear. It's at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and they refuse to hang it up. It's in storage. I want everyone to look at the reproduction online and write to the Met and say, please hang up your Rockwells.
All right. And what about you, Stephanie?
Well, I'm going to direct everybody to the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. We have the world's largest collection of original Rockwell art, and there are so many treasures in the collection, many very unexpected things that span the entire breadth of his collection. So you really get to see him grow as an artist. And to understand, you know, how his interests really changed and evolved over his lifetime.
All right. Well, what a fascinating show this has been, and if I do say so myself, and but I owe it all to Deborah Solomon.
Go ahead,
actually.
Compliment yourself.
And,
we won't stop you.
And when you come here in January 16th at the Wadsworth Athenaeum, I will meet you and I will tell you my Eric Erickson story.
Colin, thank you for all your incredibly smart and penetrating questions. It's been an honor, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving, Deborah Solomon. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you out there. We'll be back with a brand new show on Monday. But, yeah, listen to our Beatles show, which we love, on Friday.
Oh, where is Norman Rockwell? Where is Norman Rockwell? Where is Norman Rockwell now?
I'm Kyone Wolf. I'm not sure which Rockwell I want to buy, the one with a guy Facebooking under the covers while his wife gently weeps next to him, or the one with a teenage girl that's texting LOL, but she's not actually laughing at all. I'll take them both.